Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Late Drop presented by Future Fins. Support Futures because they support us and they support this very guy in his boards to surf the biggest waves in the world, Dylan Longbottom. Here's our guest today on The Late Drop, and today we go over about the surfer shaper relationship, how important that is. Dylan's up and coming big wave surfer daughter, Summer, and just a lot about equipment, fins, board design, and where he sees the future of big wave surfing. So I really hope you enjoy the episode because I did.
I just thought, oh man, I literally just almost died.
This day just had that feel like every wave coming in was the wave of the day.
It was like a glass ceiling that was just shattered. And the next thing you know, it was like 10 levels up. Like, this is the experience I've been waiting my whole life for.
Where did you actually grow up and start surfing?
Yeah, so it was my younger years in Cronulla. My mum and dad were from Cronulla. And my dad made surfboards here for G&S, Gordon & Smith, which was probably the biggest surfboard brand in the world back then. And they had all the top guys, and it was right here in Cronulla. So I grew up as a young fella and around the factory here. But then we moved down the coast when I was like eight. And so most of my teenage years, I grew up surfing down on the South Coast. So, I was down there for, you know, learned to surf down there pretty much.
Yeah, right. And then what was, obviously your dad's in the surfing industry, and I talked to a lot of kids like Pete Mel, for example. His dad was a shaper and he grew up around Freeline and his, you know, surfing, you know, stores and that. And it seems like it definitely groomed him to who he is. And I'm guessing, you know, having a dad that was a surfer and glassed and shaped and all that definitely helped you groom who you are today.
Yeah, 100% that did. As a young grom around G&S, it was just, you know, like late 70s and the 80s, it was the factory. And just to be a little kid, I was just in awe. And, you know, dad was the glasser, and just all the guys coming through, the surfboards getting made. And then we moved down the coast. He was glassing at Mike Davis surfboards. And just, yeah, I started as a young kid sweeping the shaping bays. And, yeah, it's just so cool to be able to grow up in that atmosphere around all the surfboard makers and just see the surfboards change. And yeah, I was so lucky, but it was so cool. And it definitely, you know, it was a seed for me, and it was something that I wanted to do in my life, yeah.
Was it something that you knew at a young age, you know, that you're like, surfing going to be my life? Or because, you know, in Australia, like, we play football in the winter, you know, you play for your local footy team or whatever it may be. But did you do that type of stuff growing up as well? Or was it just surfing was just it? Your dad was in it, you were in it, and that was just sort of your only passion?
Yeah, it was. It wasn't until I was like in my early 20s that I was done a bricklaying apprenticeship. I was a brickie, and, you know, I played footy when I was young, and I skated. I'd done lots of things. We lived in a squash court when I was young, so I'd done many sports. And it wasn't, I was just lucky enough to, it was there, but it wasn't until I was in my early 20s that, you know, I was sponsored by Billabong, but I was just getting enough to get my trips paid for, and I had to live. And then my partner, Martinique, she was like, what do you want to do? And I was like, I didn't want to lay bricks the rest of my life. So she goes, what are you going to do? And I said, I wanted to shape, you know. I grew up around the factories, and that was my passion, to make surfboards. So, but I was like, had to start again in my early 20s. So, but yeah, I was kind of all there, but I hadn't tapped back into it. So, yeah.
Yeah, so it's very Australian, right? You go to high school. You know, if you're not looking at going to university, it's, you go get a trade, right? Whether it's building, carpentry, you know, plumbing, tiling, electrician. It seems very, a normal thing to do in Australia. So, yeah, it's funny because you went definitely a different route. Because did you compete? You know, because, you know, obviously in Australia we have the Pro Junior Series, which is that high level series that, you know, mostly you see Fanning and Parco and all the greats usually go through that. Was that something that you, like, did you compete or like competing at a younger age? Was it anything that you sort of like thought, hey, you know, maybe I could be a pro surfer, or sort of like you said, did you just go through the motions and then into your 20s, you realize that that's what was going to happen?
Yeah, I did compete. I competed a lot. You know, I grew up with Mick Lowe here and, you know, there's Todd Prestige and Jake Spooner, all these guys are like legends. And right through, we had our Billabong Pro Junior Series. It was awesome what we had growing up, you know, and our state titles and all that. But I kind of didn't suit my surfing, and I did all right. But you know, after the heat, I'd get knocked out early, but then I'd be down the beach and, you know, like 80s and 90s, and then I'd be blasting these huge airs, but I couldn't do it in my heat. I just wasn't suited to the criteria compared to someone like Lowy, and he killed it. So, and then I was lucky Billabong picked me up when I was 18 and I was at Pro Junior, and they just see me surfing down the beach and they were just like, and instantly put me into that free surfing category. And I started just doing trips, you know, photo trips for Australian Surf and Life and tracks and video parts with, you know, I started traveling with Margot and Oki and, you know, Munga Barry. So yeah, I was kind of lucky. And then I done 1 year on the WQS. I went around Europe and that, but the waves were tiny and it just didn't suit my surfing. I surfed more the bigger waves. So yeah, I was lucky enough that it just started my free surfing career.
Yeah, it's funny because I mean, know where the glory is, right? All the surfing mags were just, you know, full fire, and like they were coming out with all the DVDs on with the surfing life, and you got to see, you know, surfing movies were at a, you know, seemed like there was one every month coming out. You could go to your bowling, you know, the bolo, and they'd have a surf night. You go watch the movies, and I remember vividly my first, when I knew about Dylan Longbottom was, I don't know if I'm going to get this right, but was it Frame Lines? Frame Lines was a Billabong movie, right? I remember. And that's when you were doing connected surfing in that, right? Yes. To this day, still one of the, I remember going back and watching that. That was one of those, I just kept hitting on repeat. I was like, shit, man, like this guy is ripping. Like, and then you had the connected and you were doing all those crazy flips and twists. And I was like, wow, who is this guy? You know? And to me, that was my first, like, that's where I was introduced to Dylan Longbottom. And it's so cool. Cause I mean, if you think about Billabong back in the day, like, you know, when I was at Burley, growing up at Burley, and, you know, Rasta was right there. And then you had yourself, and like you said, you had Margot and Oki was there, and there was just so many good surfers. And then you guys had the Billabong Adventure Division, and Laurie, you know, that's when Laurie was at the peak of his coming up powers as well. And I'm guessing we'll get to Laurie and yours relationship later, but I'm guessing that's where you two guys sort of started to, you know, get to know each other as well. But what a good time to be, like, you know, getting picked up and having like the support in that moment.
Yeah, that's kind of when my career started really taking off, was around that time. They connected me with a filmer named Barley Strickland, and our first movie we made was called Evolve, and then it was Frame Lines. And yeah, so we were doing trips, me, Margot, and Rasta, and Donovan Frankenrider would come over, and I'd bring him down here to the South Coast and surf in all our slabs and beaches and reefs, and we were just all having such a good time and filming. And yeah, that was at the time when videos were big, you know. And yeah, so for us, it was kind of easy for me because we'd surf the slabs when they were on, and when they weren't, I'd take them to all my beach breaks when I was onshore, and it was so good for airs and just, you know, high performance surfing. And me and Barley kind of connected really good. And we just got so much good clips. And yeah, it was just such a good time. And then we're going up, we're shooting Burley, we're shooting a lot of places around Australia. Then we're going to Indo, we're going to Tahiti. Yep. We're going everywhere. Yeah, it was a really fun part. And that was when I started getting paid by Billabong good. And I just chased swells all around the world. It was unreal. And in between, I'd be shaping boards and then testing the boards while making these video parts. And yeah, it was such an awesome time. I'm so blessed to, you know, be a free surfer through that time.
Yeah. So you did you finish school? Did you finish like year 12 and did your apprenticeship, or did you jump out in year 10 and start it?
No. So yeah, I jumped out of year 10 and kind of just had, you know, 6 months off and then just wanted to surf, you know, but obviously I wasn't getting paid then. I had to do something. So, you know, like you said, in Australia, we kind of do something. So, but it was a kind of blessing in disguise doing the bricklaying apprenticeship. So I actually, when I moved from Cronulla, we moved to a place called Dapto. It's actually inland. And we had to catch
Dapto
train.
Dapto dogs.
Dapto doggies, yeah. So it was, yeah, everyone knows the Dapto dogs. And it was a real footy town. And but it was so cool growing up there. We had to catch a train to the beach. And, you know, it made us really appreciate the beach. So we'd just go there no matter what. And a lot of the guys, the older guys, ended up started taking me. I was too young to drive and we'd catch a train. All these older guys were real underground, really good surfers, and they were footy players and bricklayers, and they were kind of I really looked up to them, and I ended up getting a job with them and doing the apprenticeship, but they were cool. Like they would go, well, look, if the surf's pumping, or if you have a contest or a surf trip, just do it, deal. You know, if your sponsors want you to do it, just go, and you know, we won't pay you, but just. So I was kind of lucky, and they taught me a lot about life and working hard, and actually trained my eye to hand-eye coordination for the shaping, because everything was just perfect, you know. And it kind of worked out good, you know. It taught me a lot about life and, you know, about people and street life and skill, like all sorts of stuff, you know, how to treat people. So, yeah, it was good.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like it's nearly a disservice to have these kids, because like unless you're a Mick or a Joel and you set yourself up for life, you know, you can be 16 and out of school, make a ton of good money, but then very rare do those kids, you know, they get to 23, 24, they haven't made it, they get dropped and they've spent all their money and then they've got to go and find a job and all they know is surfing, and it's such a culture shock that they some of them just can't get their head around it. Whereas, you know, if you understand what it is to make a dollar bricklaying or laying tiles or going working, you know, 8 to 4, you appreciate being able to get paid to go and travel and go and surf. So I sometimes think it's nearly better if it's the opposite way. If you maybe don't make it early, but you know, you appreciate what it takes, and then later down the track you're able to get into that, you know, sponsored, you know, life, it's nearly better, I think.
Yeah, that's what I did. I didn't have a choice. And yeah, for sure. Like I've seen so many guys, like I'm 48 now, I'm still doing it. Billabong still sponsored me as a free surfer at 48. I've been doing it for 30 years. I've been sponsored by Billabong for 29 years now. And so it gave me a long way and it made me really appreciate it. Where and I've been doing it so long, I've seen so many guys, and they went down that contest track or getting big money early, but they had nothing to fall back on, and then by 25 they had they dropped off, you know, weren't getting paid anymore, and they're just like, what do I do? You know, I've seen so many, not just Australian guys all around the world, and then so for me it was get a job and free surfer for Billabong. I had a really good lifestyle, but my bricklaying was my income. Where, you know, so I was lucky I'd done it early in life, where Laurie was the opposite, Laurie Towner, my team rider, and he got paid really good, like, and he was, you know, one of the best. And then he just finished his tiling apprenticeship now. He'd done it after, you know, so, but I guess it's all, you know, depends on where the good person at, but like I said, I was lucky to, in a way, you know, I thought I was the unlucky one and I had to do it tough compared to a lot of guys, but it worked out good in the end.
Yeah. And then, you know, and you got the shaping too. And going back to shaping, like you said, like when was the first time you shaped? How old were you when you shaped your first board?
So, yeah, I was 24. Yeah. And it was the best board I ever made. One of my trainer, Ryan, at the gym yesterday, he goes, what's your favorite ever board? And I told him, I said, mate, it was my first board I ever shaped. And that's wow. pretty crazy, you know. I grew up with my dad working at Gordon Smith, and, you know, but that boards were totally different then. And then and then I was sponsored by Nev, for who was probably one of the best shapers in the world back then in the mid-90s. And I was sponsored by him, again, amazing boards for years. And then when I picked up that planer, there was no machines back then, I picked up that planer and this, you know, it was all in my head. I knew what I wanted, and I made this board, and it was one of them boards I just connected with and just could do anything. And wow. I ended up making the final, the first air show in Australia. Aussie Wright just got me in the final, and I had cover for shots on it. I'd done so many video parts, and it was probably the the best board ever. It was crazy. So then
that's funny,
that, that just set me off, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's funny because I was going to say, like, I would think that you were saying that because of the personal connection, you know, you'd be like, oh, it's the greatest board. But like, legitimately, it was like you could do anything on it. That's crazy that your first ever board was like that.
I could do anything. I'd surf a 2-foot onshore beachy on the South Coast and be punting, you know, biggest airs to, then I was surfing the slabs down here on it. I think it was a personal connection, but it just one of them boards that you just didn't have to think, and I could just do whatever I wanted. And yeah, so, and then I ended up breaking it and putting it back together, but it was a board that I just kept going back to and my shaping years for years after that. And, you know, the curves I used and everything. So, but it was quite hard, you know, but back then it was planing, and it was a lot of trial and error and guessing and feeling. And yeah, so and shaping, it's just, you know, I'm still learning today, and it's something you'll always learn, like surfing. And and you just, you're testing and changing and, you know, feeling everything out. And yeah, it's been a long process for sure.
Yeah. When was, I know the South Coast has some amazing, amazing waves, heavy, big waves. That, you know, were you around then when they had the Billabong Challenge down there when they did that?
Yeah.
With Oki, and they, that was, I mean, they, that, that goes to show you what type of waves are down there, but. Was that a, was that in your time down there?
Yeah, yeah. So I was probably, you know, I guess I must have been in my late teens then. And yeah, I was surfing those swells in my area, which is a bit north of that. That was down the coast further. But that really showcased them waves down there. That really put that on the map. But yeah, it's, you know, it's well known. It's pretty littered with really good reef, world-class reef breaks the whole coastline now. Yeah, that's amazing. Some of the best.
Yeah,
in the
I mean. Yeah, for sure. And then when did the big wave thing, the bug sort of get you? Because if you look at your career, you know, like from start, like you obviously you did the pro juniors, but you were like really good at airs, and you were doing the air shows, and you obviously had a, you know, you obviously could think ahead of, like, because that connected surfing, how, I want to get back to that. How were you doing that connected surfing back like 15, 20 years ago?
Okay, yeah, so that was probably, it was probably still around the same time I started to, you know, with jet skis and that started coming off, and we started tow waves, you know, and most of the waves I grew up with weren't tow waves, so that was more when I started going, well, my first video surfing magazine, which was for Australian Surfing Life, was to Tahiti, and that was with... Margo, Munga, Bahari, and Poto back in the 90s. So, and it was when no one knew of Chopu. So, but I've been going there for 30 years, and that was where I really started tow surfing. But the kinetic surfing, which I found these straps, the guys in Hawaii, you know, Led Hamilton, and I think it was Rush Randall, was called X-Strap.
Yeah.
It was a strap where you could paddle. You didn't need a jet ski, and you could paddle, and then you could slip your feet in. So it was more like snowboarding airs, which really I snowboard a lot down here and skate a lot. And I wanted to do all these rotations, and I could do it without a jet ski. So I actually stuck them on my, it was my brother's first ever board. My dad made them here in Cronulla at Gordon Smith, and they had the craziest sprays on it. My brother had Ace Frehley from Kiss, probably the best airbrush ever. And I had Gene Simmons, and I stuck them on this twinny, and it was super thick, so I was really easy to paddle. And I started doing these rotations, you know. I really want to do a McTwist and backflips and 540s. And I started doing them. This was around, you know, the early 2000s. And it was so fun. People were like, oh, it doesn't count. It's instructing. But I was like, oh, whatever, you know. It's like snowboarders. They could do the same without snowboarding. It was just a different form of surfing, which I loved. And yeah, I just kept pushing it. And I felt I could really push the limits of aerial surfing. Yeah. And nobody was really doing, except for a couple of Hawaii guys over there.
Yeah. Yeah. Rush was the king, I think, at that. And like I said to you earlier, when I watching that frame lines and seeing those, I'm not sure where you were surfing, but it was that killer left. I'm not sure if it was Indo or somewhere, but you were doing those massive big rotations and coming down backwards, fakey, and sliding back around. It was like, I was just like, wow, that looks incredible.
Yeah, the height I could get was so much more than without straps, and still to this day. The speed I could spin and the rotations, I just couldn't do that without them straps. So yeah, then go to Indo and these perfect shape reef breaks that allow, you know, these perfect ramps. And yeah, I was on trips with Rasta and Margo and, you know, Benji Welly, and they were just like tripping. Luke Egan. And it was just so fun to me. It was pretty dangerous, you know, how fast I was going and how hard I was hitting it and where I was trying to land. I was trying to land on the face on the down ramp, you know, like a snowboard ramp. And when I when I connected, it just felt amazing. And yeah, I made some things I was just dreamt of, like, so yeah, it was awesome, you know. And they, you would have seen them in frame lines. And there was, yep, there was the next movie after that was called The Freeway. And yeah, it was sick, you know. And then when I went to the Tour Motus with a bunch of Hawaiian guys and for another ASL video, and I was doing them there and on the front side, and then I was taking them to P Pass and doing some crazy rotations there on a trip with Kong and Asher Pacey and all that. So yeah, it was really fun times. And yeah, so now I'm kind of bringing it back, working on my own strap that people are like, yeah, they want it, you know. So it's something you can just paddle in on your local beach break and do, you know, do some crazy airs that you couldn't do without straps.
Yeah. It's got to be a great way for the young kids to be able to practice rotations in real time, instead of, like, you know, I guess you see the, you know, that big Australian, what is it, down at Casarina, you know, when they can jump into the foam pit and practice and all that, but nothing like actually doing it. And Kai Lenny's been doing it a little bit as well. I think you can see it at the wave pools, and definitely seems like it's something you can really tighten up your air game for sure. And practice those crazy rotations that no one's been doing.
Yeah, exactly. It's probably the best way to practice. And you know, simulating in on a wave is different. So, you know, yeah, you see Kai Lenny doing it now a lot, which is good. And now with all the pools, I just think it's a great time to bring it back for the kids, and especially the pools and stuff, and then practice the rotations and then be able to do it without. So yeah, it's, you know, I definitely think it's a part of the future.
Yeah. So when was it, I said that before, but when is it that you really, you know, realize that you really loved the heavy water? And, you know, cause it's different in Australia, right? Like our big waves are like slabs. They're not so much like tall, like Jaws or Mavericks or Waimea, but they're just really thick, heavy, shallow water slabs, you know. And when did you get a sense that, like, this was something that you really loved? And then, you know, was it, and then, when did you and Laurie, and when did that whole relationship start to take place? And I, you know, I'm interested to hear about that start, yeah, that stage of your
so
life.
So it was always in me, and growing up, you know, like I said, I was pretty blessed to grow up on the south coast there, all them slabs. So that's where it really started for me. And as a young girl, I'm like growing up with my brother Dazza, and then I'd just be, you know, and all my mates, we'd have a big crew of mates, and it was a natural progression. So we started surfing these slabs, like, you know, they were 6 foot, but they were quite chunky and really shallow, you know, probably like 1 foot of water. And I'd just take off on anything. And they'd just be going, what are you doing, dude? Like, I'd just take off on the ugliest things and try and make it. So it was, that was really, you know, doing that for years. And all the mates going, you're crazy, dude. But that was, I just felt like I could do it. And I felt like if that was a way of making it, I would just go for it. So learning on these reefs really set me up. And then, you know, they'd only get to probably, you know, the biggest would be maybe 8 to 10 feet, but real slabby. So it wasn't so much in height, but they were so heavy, you know. It wasn't, like I said, it wasn't so much high. So paddling into that taught me so much. And then I started going to Indo and, you know, I kind of stumbled across Apocalypse and then surfing all them reefs. And then I started going to Hawaii in my younger years and paddling Pike. And that's when the height started to come in and surfing Sunset. A bunch of us, that's where we'd stay at Sunset there. And we'd just surf Sunset huge. And that's when the height started coming in. And then coming back to Australia. And then we started surfing Shipsterns. And that's when I really started tow surfing with Margot and Adventure Visions kind of. For Billabong really was born, and we started, you know, Doreen started coming over and we'd grab Parco, and then that's where like we're really big slabs. We would paddle it, and but we'd also tow it because on the bigger days you couldn't, it was too big to paddle, so we started towing.
Yeah.
And then and then it was at the same time I teamed up with Manoa Drillette. He was sponsored by Billabong. I was like, oh, this is going to be sick, because I was already going there from a young age, and I've been staying at the same family at the Mummy and Poppy Manny's there, and really formed this connection with Chopu and paddling it for years. And me and Manoa teamed up, and for me, he was still the best, probably natural footer to ever surf that reef. And to team up and be my tow partner there really taught me so much about the wave and towing. And then, so every swell I'd fly over to Chopu and start a towing, and sometimes it'd just be me and him out. It'd be huge and windy and wild. And I'd just be going like, where is everyone? You know, it was at a time when, you know, Poto might come out and then, but you know, on the really good swells, Dorian and Ian Walsh would come over, and we surf so many crazy swells together. And, yeah, for years, you know. So, and then Laurie started coming, you know. Well, I'll go back to Shipsterns, and that's when I took Laurie down to Shipsterns when he was 16. And the contest, the Quickie Pro, was called off. So we told Andy.
Was that that first swell? Is that the one where the famous wave that he paddled into? Was that his first trip down?
Yeah, that was his first trip. He was 16 going on 17, and me and Margot were going, and the Quickie Pro was called off, so we took Andy Irons and Parco, and then I was like, Laurie, you've got to come, man, because he just got that crazy one at Backdoor the season before, and I knew he was up for it, mate. You got to come with us, you know, and I just started shaping boards for him. I was shaping for Billabong boards up at JS's. I was living in Queensland, and I just started making boards for Laurie. So, yeah, he was 16. And so I took him down, and, yeah, it was huge and perfect, and the five of us. And, yeah, I started towing, and I got a few, and I was at the boat changing boards, and Andy and Laurie were paddling, and that's when Laurie was on a 7.2 I shaped for him, and that goes to show how far back it was. We were riding a lot bigger boards in them days. He paddled that thing. Andy was a bit wider, but to get in the perfect spot, you kind of got to take off deep and just pack that thing. And yeah, he got that wave. I was on the boat changing boards and to watch that thing. And yeah, for him to see, do that at that young age, and with Andy there and Parco there and Margot, and the day was amazing. We all paddled so many good ones. We all towed so many good ones. And yeah, it was, you know, we connected for sure. You know, he was riding my boards, and I was kind of, you know, I'd been going there and mentoring him and saying, you need this board. And it was the first tow board I ever made him. He rode it that day. So, yeah, it was cool.
And, he's such a good guy. I had him on the podcast, and, you know, and we'll get to the code Red Swell. But so when did – because Manoa sort of just stepped away, right? He sort of just was like – I'm sort of done. I'm done with it, and sort of just vanished, which is sort of, it was sort of weird. But I mean, his brother has just taken the mantle.
So now,
talk about Oh, talk about passing the torch, mate. That guy is incredible out there.
What? It's so cool because, you know, now his little brother is the best. He is doing things like taking it beyond the next level. That's why I said Manoa, natural footer. Now his younger brother paddling is just like, he's just taken off way back, sitting on foam boards, doing unimaginable stuff, towing the same. And I'm stoked. Yeah. I'm shaping his boards too and connected with Matahi, and it's so cool. But yeah, Manoa just kind of, he just lost his passion, I think. And you know, mm-hmm. We're putting our lives on the line and charging, and it didn't feel like we're getting compensated for what we're doing. I was kind of lucky. So he was kind of like, he'd get one or two waves on a toe swell and he'd just be telling me, and it'd be just like, so I was getting so many waves. Manoa told me, he knew the ones, he knew the best ones, the biggest. He'd sit there and wait, and he taught me the line. Yeah. He was the one that taught me the lines to surf it. And I was so lucky, so blessed for Manoa to spend so many years there with him, for sure. Just, he taught me so much. Like, and then going to Code yeah. Red, that was the accumulation of him teaching me over the years, for sure.
I was about to say, because it's such a, you know, certain people have certain, you can just tell that's, they feel like, for you, it's Chopu. You know, I can tell it's probably your favorite wave. It's, you've probably had the best waves of your life out there. You've got a connection with the local people that stay there. They love you. You love them. And there's something to be said about having that special relationship with a place, because you can tell, you know, and going to Fast 14, to Code Red, you know, that whole crazy, from what I can gather, Raymana was out early, got super slammed, sort of was like, hey, it's too dangerous, someone's going to die, shut it down. And then you guys were having a hard time getting out there, just getting shut down and this and that. And then by the time you guys got out there, you guys were the only ones out there, right? And then you're like, what? Where is everyone? And I think from what I saw is that what you're talking about, the knowledge, the time, the lines, because when you guys started towing, and Laurie was the same, Laurie obviously got that from you and you got that from Manoa, you could see the lines that you guys were taking. And not only that, the most impressive thing was the waves you were selecting on the ski, because there was a lot of waves that people were taking that were closeouts, that people weren't making them, but you guys went out and I want to say nearly had like a 90% success strike rate on your wave selection.
Yeah, so most guys that day only got one wave and got hammered, you know. I was lucky. We were out there nearly all day from the time we got out there, which was probably around 9:30 or something like that. We stayed out there till nearly 4 o'clock, and I made all my waves that day. I got like 10 waves. It was unbelievable. Same with Laurie, but Laurie fell on a few. He just went probably a little bit too deep. But he was, you know, and it wasn't a fluke. It was years of going to that reef, years of shaping my boards and dialing them in, years of with Manoa, years of wipeouts, years of near-death experiences, going too deep, not going deep enough. The speed that we went that day was just like the first thing Laurie said after he ended up going first. Obviously, and then his face, and then I just said, what was it like that? And he goes, mate, just hold on, man. It's the fastest I've ever been in my life. Like, so I was ready for that. And I knew that because a couple of times when I towed the huge swells, I'm going from my inside rail on my back end to my outside rail, which is so opposite on your back end to any other wave you surf. And so, you know, I was pressing so hard. My first one was just like it was the wave I dreamt of, you know. I had all the biggest swells over the last 15 years. And then to be this one, and it was the one I dreamed of, you know, riding it so deep, letting go way early and being way back behind it where, you know, it was just unbelievable. And I just remember just going so fast. It was incredible. For years, like I actually, you know, starting to shape and travel with Laurie it was, you know, it was a swell. We surfed with Laird Hamilton, and, you know, Laird was our guru, you know, and then we were out in a swell years before that with Laird. And Laurie had never ridden a jet ski. And so he towed me, and I had to teach him how to use a jet ski, how to tow me in, you know, at 15 to 20 foot chopu. So I taught him how to ride a jet ski of his huge day. So it was years of towing with him then. And yeah, everything just come together on that day. So yeah.
Yeah. I think another thing that probably is underlooked is the equipment, right? Because being the surfer shaper and being able to tweak your equipment, what do you think most people did wrong that day? Like, do you think that it was equipment that like was, because for example, say, you know, that wave that Bruce got, and it looks like he's making it. And then it's like, he just got sucked, like something just sucked him down into the vortex, right? Like what, from your experience, like what did you do different with your boards, or what did you see that was wrong with other people's boards?
Yeah. Like, I don't want to like say bad anything, but I learned a lot for sure. And I learned so much over the years before that, surfing my boards and, you know, surfing so many swells there with Laird and talking to Laird, because he made his own boards and he was towing Jaws, and I'd ask him, hey, what are you doing to your boards and this and that? And, but he was doing the same as me. So I was glassing him and having the weight distributed over the whole board. So for his early Jaws tow boards, he had like 6 layers of 6 ounce, where some of the other tow boards were like epoxy, and then they had weights just in the middle of the board, so the weight wasn't distributed evenly, so it didn't feel like it had enough weight on the nose. And especially at somewhere where chopu, where there was so much, I couldn't believe how so much water would come up the face and really want to pull you up the face. So some of the other guys' boards didn't have that weight distributed evenly, where they got sucked up, and they had some different edges as well, where mine was more of a surfboard and it had weight distributed evenly, and where you could actually surf the board still, not so much like a just like on a train track where you had your one line. We could adjust our line, which you have to at chopu. You're going from outside rail to inside rail, and you're going so fast. So I think they're little differences I worked out over the years, and I did see them guys riding them other boards and not making them as good, and it happened on that day, on the Code Red day, and I stoked all the guys on my board were the guys making the waves, which for me, like I got so much out of the waves I got, you know, but for me to see the guys make their waves on my boards, I felt like I was there with them, you know. I was like, and that to me was just as special, being their shaper as a surfer, getting my own barrels.
Yeah. What was it like there that day? Like what, like as being a, you've been there so many times, but pulling up on the Code Red day and the water, like the water just looked like it was a tsunami. Looked like there was just a tsunami running, the way the water was moving. Like what did it feel like seeing that?
Yeah, so a lot of the other times we had some big and perfect ones, and there was one other time, the solid swell in 2005. It was the swell when the Red Bull jet ski went over Ramana's head, and Brock Little was towing me, and that was my first ever time I towed, and I was on the Garrett was on the way behind that, and then I was on the next wave, and I borrowed Andy's board, you know, and. That swell was pretty, you know, it was pretty dark water and angry. But then this Code Red day was even next level, and the water moving, and it was like a tsunami of, you know, but it was just the whole ocean imploding, and just like it looked nearly unrideable. Like, but yeah, we just kind of put that aside us, but and then started riding it. And when me and Laurie made our first waves, and then that's when everyone started coming back out. But, it definitely felt like we're on another planet, or it was just like, it was extreme. It was super extreme, and it was scary, super scary.
Yeah. What's, so best wave was Code Red. What about your worst, what's the worst experience you've had out there?
It was the Halloween swell, which was like in November. It was really late for the season. I guess it was around the mid-2000s, and yeah, I felt prime. The boards were going good. That's when I was telling Manoa, and I got the sometimes the second wave of the set out there are kind of bigger, but they're gnarlier. All the water's gone off the reef, and then sometimes you get a bit of foam. And I took off pretty deep on a really big west one. It was the second wave of the set, and them days we didn't have, you know, inflatables, so I just wore one vest over it, and it kind of wasn't enough. And on the, you know, on the Code Red day, I wore two life jackets over each other.
Yeah,
you know, it's just like safety. I've got kids, I want to be safe as possible. And I remember taking off on this one, and it was huge, and it was one of them real growers, and it was the second wave of the set, so it really drained, had not much water on it, and then it had all the foam on it on the end bowl. And as I was trying to hold on to my inside rail where I, you know, knew this new line, I changed my line too early to try and get out before the closeout. And I just went too early. I panicked and you know, it was the early days of learning. So I knew not to do that again. But I tried to kick out a little bit too early, and I went over, and I had a two-wave hold down out there. Right in that death zone where I was all vortexing, I was just kind of stuck there. And when I thought I was going to come up, it pulled me back down. And yeah, so I finally come up, and Manoa, it was them old jackets with the handle, had a handle so you can kind of grab it. And as I come up, yep. I closed the blacking out, I guess. And I got my, yep. I finally come up, luckily got my breath. And he, as I come up, he grabbed me and kind of grabbed me by the back of my neck with that handle. And the filmer, Kendall, one of Laurie's good mates, was just like, had to sit on the boat and regather myself. But that was probably the worst, you know, I've hit the reef pretty hard out there, but that was probably the near-death experience for sure.
Wow. Yeah, it's no joke, man.
It was something that, you know, the power out there is unbelievable. The force, yeah, you get wrecked on it. It just can throw you around and pin you down. And the force there is just crazy. And then until I surf Nazare, and then that's a different level.
Well, one last question on Chopu, but is there's you guys got to do the filming for Point Break too, right? How was that? I mean, that must have been pretty cool. It's they shut it down, and I think it was you and Bruce were able to do the follow cam and all that stuff. What was that experience like?
That was the best. It was such a good experience, and you know, the years leading up, because we were waiting for years, and they contacted me and Laurie, and they said, look, do you want to? They contacted, said, yeah, matched the description for Bodie, and Laurie matched the description for Johnny Utah. And, you know, like, this is our all-time, one of our favorite Hollywood movies. So, you know, we're kind of pinching ourselves, going, this is for real. You know, it didn't seem real, but we're just kind of tripping. And then it was cool for me. Then they asked me to make all the boards for the movie. I made, like, 35 boards for the movie. So I also got to shape all the boards for the movie, which was also awesome. And so I was kind of, when I was making the boards, like, this is happening, you know. And then to go there, and I had Billy Kemper there with me to back me up, and Laurie had Bruce. And then when it finally come, you know, we'd done all this stuff, you know, we're working on a Hollywood set, which was crazy, you know. It was such a great experience, and everyone was so cool. You just see what goes into making a Hollywood movie, which was cool. But, you know, doing all the underwater stuff was pretty heavy. But then when it come to the big, we finally got the day, and they're like, we're shutting the lineup down. Laird's towing Laurie and Raymond's towing Dylan. And we just looked at each other. We're like, holy shit. This is this is going to be amazing. But then the sad note, Laurie got hurt straight off his third wave. Yeah. He got two crazy ones. It was pretty bad. And I was out the back. There was a bit of fluff going on with Manoa. It's like I was caught in this thing with, you know, because a few of the surfers wanted to stay out. And I was just like, let's start going, you know. But at that time, Laurie got hurt. I didn't know. They come out, told me, and I see the chopper go, and Laurie, so I kept on asking, what happens, Laurie, is he all right? He's all right. And they go, no, he's all right. So And then I had to refocus. Yeah. So, and then Bruce started surfing, and then got some crazy ones. And they said, "Yeah, you ready?" And I said, "Yeah, yeah, let's do it." And Bruce was like, but he kind of didn't know what I was doing. So I took off, because I took off on my line that I usually do from Manoa right up deep. And we'd done a crossover, and I done a high line over him, come down, and then I had to look back at him in the barrel, go, "Follow my line." Wow. Told him. And then so I'm looking back into the barrel, telling him to follow my line, and he's just looking at me, go, "Ah!" And then I, as I turn back around, I'm looking back out of the barrel, get spat out, and we're just high-fiving each other, just frothing, and the whole film set frothing, and it's just, we kept doing that for a couple of days. And yeah, and then we went back, and then the next world we're doing POV stuff and with big cameras, and yeah, it was just an awesome experience, yeah, for sure. So blessed, so like stoked, wanted to tell the kids and the grandkids, and yeah.
That's awesome. So what's you know, obviously, you know, Chopu and some slabs, like what other ways did you like to chase, you know, when you were with the Billabong Adventure Division? Like, did you get to go and do Jaws? Did you you know, was there, what was on your radar as a big wave surfer, like looking for waves when you saw swells on the map?
Yeah, so mainly the Adventure Division, we're kind of focusing on all the Australian reefs and big waves. And then obviously, you know, we're looking at some other ways around Tahiti and Indo. But that's what, no, we weren't, you know, I guess Jaws was just kind of happening. They're still towing that. And then I guess it was a bit later, they started, or you guys started paddling it and Mavericks, but we were more focused, which would have been cool, but we were more focused on the big Australian stuff, which was all kind of, you know, all these reefs were getting found around Australia, like, and still to this day, there's so many, being such a big country. So we're really trying to find these new ways in, you know, each state in Australia, which so many, which was cool.
Yeah, I guess hence the Adventure Division, you know, trying to go out and find stuff that hasn't been done before and document it.
Yeah, and it was cool.
So but, did, you're right, sorry.
Yeah, I was just saying, because then we're going to come. There were some crazy new slabs we were finding, and, you know, they were fully shark infested. It was like, wow, like the places we're going to, yeah.
Did you ever have any inclination? Like when, you know, when did it start to slow down for you, as in like being able to chase the waves like that? Did you ever have, like, did Mavericks and Jaws ever sort of like, was it something that you had like wanted to go and try out, or did it sort of, the timing just never really worked out?
Yeah, it was something that I always wanted to, both Jaws and Mavericks, but it just, timing didn't work out for me. I then, you know, end up spending a lot of my life in Indo, which was a huge part of my life, so I'd be I shaped there a lot for all the crew, and I'd be bouncing between there and Australia. And then the last 5 years, it was Nazaré that I and Morocco with Jerome, and so I was more focusing on, it was Europe, Indo, Australia, and so it wasn't until like the last couple of years, well, just before COVID, because I shaped for Lucas Chumbo now. He's my kind of my main team rider with Laurie and Matahi. The Lucas is really focused on Mavericks and Jaws and Nazaré. So, and then, and now I started, got interest to come and shape over there. But COVID's here and it's kind of just put a stop on things, but it's, you know, that my shaping is taking me to them places. And, you know, after spending so much time in Indo and focusing on that, that took me to Portugal and met this amazing crew, a factory there called Org Surfboards. And they sponsor a lot of the Nazaré guys. And then that all happened and kicked off. And that's when me and Lucas connected. And then I was shooting down to Morocco and surfing these crazy waves with Jerome. And so the shaping, it was kind of lucky. That's why I've been doing it, I guess, so long now, into my, you know, late 40s and still doing it, that I'm doing it because of my shaping. And I go and surf.
Yeah.
I go to shape it's more about shaping now, but I get to surf too, and it goes hand in hand. So, you know, I got off the plane and to Portugal and met this crew, Antonio Silva and Joel de Macedo, with the boss of Org at Edu, and they go, oh, we're going, it's going to be 60 foot tomorrow in Nazaré. Okay, you'll be right, Dil. You surf these crazy waves. And I took my Chopu towboard, and God, man, I'd learn a lot, you know. And I was just like, what am I? Yeah. Shit, I've got off a plane. I'm driving straight to Nazaré. But I was going there to shape. But they're taking me there.
Yeah. No, it's funny because I was going to say, like, you, I mean, obviously you've always been around, but for me, it seems like your surfboard shaping has brought you back into the forefront, right? Because, you know, like I think I remember seeing you in Portugal at Nazaré just one time, just hanging out there, and then I remember that day that you did go surf. And I want to say too, you, I think you even towed your daughter into a wave out there at some stage as well, right? And so I mean, it's sort of cool that, you know, your boards and you know, it's like, it's weird, you know, you go through, your career goes through phases where it's like, you know, and then you get cold or you get hot again. It seems like Dylan Longbottom is sort of like you're very back into the forefront, especially, I would say, especially now in the big wave world, because, you know, you do have Chumbo and I think you're shaping some boards for Justine DuPont and you are seeing your boards around a lot, you know, and it's cool because you not only, you know, have advice about boards, but you know, you're the guy that can shape the boards, but could go out and whip them into the best wave of your life, or also jump on the rope and go get a better one than anyone as well, you know. So it's a perfect situation to be in, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely been like that, and yeah, I just like, oh well, when am I going to stop doing this? But I, you know, I just want to try and keep fitting. I still love doing it. Like at the end of the day, you know, if there was a swell at Chopu tomorrow, I would go, or Nazaré, or wherever in the world. I still love being out. Or even if I'm, you know, I probably won't catch as many as I used to as I was younger, but I still love being out in that energy. And now I'm you know, I'll be at Cape Salander here with all the boys and my daughter Summer, and I like to be on the ski, like looking out for everyone and working on water safety or depot bombing and helping everyone. And I love being out there and I'm seeing the boards, seeing how they're working. And then I catch a few for myself. So yeah, it's different to any other shaper in the world. And, you know, to go to Nazaré and surf that wave and understand how the boards work and how fast you go and how long you got to hold your speed for. And then to go to surf a slab in Morocco or to the slabs in Australia and then surf with Laurie Towner. Or a couple of months ago, I went down to Shipstones and surfed with shapeboards for Ryan Hipwood and surfed with him and with Parco and my daughter Summer and get instant feedback, you know, after a wave. Or Indo, I'm paddling out the Bomi or outside corner at Ulu's or surfing Desert Point, everywhere, you know. With Lucas, you know, I want to be out Mavericks with him, and even if I just get one, you know, I'd be stoked. But just to see it up front, and it's kind of cool that I'm lucky that it's kept me my surfing career right there and up the top, you know. And I just got a new board ready for Billy Kemper for you know, shaping for the best people in the world. I'm shaping for Justine DuPont now, you know, probably biggest female woman charger in the world, and you know, so. Shaping for the world's best, you know. Whenever someone's going to Chopu for the big swells, I'll be so humbled to make them for all the world's best there. It's so good.
Yeah. What would you went back and you said about Nazaré, like what was your experience, you know, like just being out there for the first time or the first time it was really big and being on the rope and surfing it? What was different compared to anything else you've ever surfed about that wave?
Oh my God, it was just like another world. It was like, again, it was like a co-red day, but on a different scale. Like like you said, I grew up surfing slabs, so they were more hollow. I was more of a tube rider rather than, you know, we didn't get waves like Jaws and Mavericks and surf them waves of heights. But to be on the ocean with that kind of height and see how fast they were moving, and I just felt like a speck of, you know, nothing. It was just like, it was scary. And then to get a few, and then I had a pretty bad experience there. It was a couple of days after your comp, your paddle comp, which was so good there to watch you guys paddling on that big perfect day when you had the WSL big wave contest. And then they had a tow swell come in. They had a WSL free surf tow day. And I'd actually, after surfing some of my tow boards, I changed my weights because I realized where you have to have weights and you have to have so much more weight out there. I changed my quads to thruster out there because there's so many bumps and much bigger back fin. And so I was more so trialing my boards, you know. I was there shaping. And then I was kind of frothing and it got kind of windy and I wanted one of them cleaner ones under the lighthouse there, the real chunky ones. So I kind of frothed out and told my driver to, I was like, this one was the first wave set and it backed off. And I just went, and I just kicked off and I just kind of wasn't thinking right. And I should have just rode it out to the beach, but I kicked out and then I didn't realize because it was so big, it was the first wave set. And then I jumped on my tow board and as my mate come to get me, he kind of panicked. And because this wave was about to break, and as I went to grab the sled, he took off and left me there. And I scratched over the, I just did the first one. I was on a tow board, you know.
Yeah.
It was nearly 10 kilos and I couldn't paddle on it. And as I scratched over the first, 50 footer, the next one already started capping and I was on first peak and the heaviest peak. And I was just like, it was one of them things. My heart just dropped. It's like, holy shit, I got to face this. I'm in the worst place here. The scariest place. Worst nightmare of your life. And I just look, this is the first time I've ever wore inflatables. So, because we never had them in my era. So, I was just like, where are these things? I didn't have time to think. I just like, all right, I just have to get my body ready and relax. And I pulled before the wave hit me. So it actually broke on my head. So I pulled, I got two pulls and I just couldn't get under the water. And I just pretty much put my head down and I had like a 50 footer break on my head. And it was the worst thing I've ever had to experience. Yeah. So, saying before that probably we're talking about Chopu, I thought we're talking about that, the worst experience. This was even gnarlier and the force that it gave me, lucky it didn't knock me out and just drove me so deep with even the inflatable. And it was black down there and oh mate, the force was unbelievable. And oh, it just, I felt I was so deep and just, the power out there was, I was just in the worst place. And luckily with all my experience and knowing how to deal with that situation. And then when I come up, I could feel my inflatable start to work after a really long time held down. I come up and I had another one to deal with. And then I had another two actually. And then I was right under that cliff in a bad spot. And I thought of Ross Clark Jones when he had to deal with it. And I was like, oh no. And watching you guys 2 days before the comp, a couple of guys got them rights and got themselves. And I remember watching that going, I don't want to be there, you know, because it was kind of the water was sucking out in front of the cliffs. And you got no, them cliffs are like 100 foot. You got nowhere to go. So, and not many ski drivers go in there. And my really good mate and partner, one of my tow partners and who I shape with over there, Antonio Silva, one of the best ski drivers, come and save me. And Sergio also, he was following him. Sergio is the man. And they come and save me. And if they didn't get me in that time, one more wave, I was on the cliff. So, it's pretty funny because we towed my daughter Summer when a couple of years before that, when she was 13. Oh, not a big day is that, but he actually saved her life. So I own twice now. It's a bit of a joke for us. So, it's a really cool bond we have. Yeah.
Yeah, you'll have strong bonds in those situations. Going back to the Finns, it's funny with when I started doing some toe surfing there years ago too, it was all about the speed, right? So everyone thought quads was the way to go because it was just, you wanted the speed, speed, speed. But it's very rare that you get those perfect days. And then I remember going back, a few years later and everyone was doing the thruster because as you can see on those big windy days, like you're getting so much air that, you know, everyone's actually getting bigger side fins and like nearly like an old school 2+1 setup where the back fin is even bigger than the side fin. So like when you catch, I'm guessing it's for when you're catching air out of the water that there's some sort of connectivity back to the wave. And is that sort of the theory behind it? Because it would seem like, again, too much fin would slow you down, but I guess having the stability is more important than cavitating out and eating it.
So yeah, my theory and experience over the years was from Chopu, and like I said, on that Code Red day, I'd never gone so fast on a board, and we rode quads out there, so my fins are in the water, and it gave me the max speed to be actually ride that line, and then I got two fins in the barrel, but I'm more going across the wave and surfing that wave where Nazaré is more of a mountain coming down, so my theory was going to Nazaré was I took my Chopu board as a quad and I thought, I just want to go as fast as I can. I don't want that thing to catch me or, you know, I want to outrun that thing. And quad, I was like, nah. And then I talked to a lot of the locals and the boys and team riders and they'll say, no, thrust. I said, no, I want to go as fast as I can. I felt comfortable doing that. And that's where I learned. I made a mistake and I had like 3 to 4 foot bumps like moguls in a ski coming up the face with wind, and I was getting airborne, and then the tail would drift, and then I lost the fins, and then I fell, and so I learned so much straight off that. So that's what I went back to the factory there in Portugal at near Lisbon and changed to quad. And then over the next few years, I actually designed my own fin for Lucas, and a lot of the boys are riding there now, and I changed the thruster, and I made a really big back fin. It's nearly like a small single fin. It's huge, really upright.
Wow.
It's like a nearly 7-inch back fin. So like you said, if you look at it, it's like a 2+1 setup. And that's what's because you're going so fast and you're getting air. You're getting air on your boards and you've got to keep that motor in the water. It's like a Thundercats in Australia, the inflatables are real heavy. And it's the same, they're going so fast, hitting chop, getting air, but that motor staying in the water, and as soon as you lose that, you're gone. So that kind of 2+1 with the big back fin and the thruster really help keep the board engaged, going at high speeds, and you're going so fast from the power of the wave at Nazaré, so you didn't have to generate more speed from a quad. So that bigger back fin and that kind of 2+1 setup really works at Nazaré, you know, because it's pretty rare unless you've got a real perfect classy day. Which is pretty rare.
It's sort of like the jet skis. You know when you see the jet skis like in the soup and they're trying to outrun, but they keep getting air. So the wave's catching you. You know, you want the impeller and to be in the water grabbing and going, but you're getting air. And every time you're in the air, you're like, no, I want to be down, like down, you know. So I guess same sort of theory in sense.
Exactly. You need to keep them fins in the water. So yeah, for sure. And then I gave it to Lucas to try and make this fin, and he just tripped out. And then I was there surfing with him, and he's just going, "Dill, this is taking me next level." And he's doing, you know, he's doing big carves out there, snaps 360 into trying to pull in. And so then everyone's seen him, what he was doing, and then so a lot of the boys asked me for that fin, so I made a heap for him, and yeah, so it was kind of cool to have Lucas there and see it and test pilot and give me that feedback.
But that's the beauty of having a shaper that surfs with you and is in the water and can really understand it, you know, especially. I mean, it's different, right? For like your general guy that goes down, surfs his 3-foot beachy, you know, like the board, the equipment, it's good, but you know, it doesn't matter that much, right? Whereas you're putting a guy out in the 80-foot surf, like, You want to make sure it's as good as it possibly can be, you know, because you don't want that guy to come in and go, man, I ate shit on that thing. Like, what's going on? You know, like, I nearly died.
I know, hey. Like, it's pretty daunting for us as shapers, you know. Like, I guess that's why I'm lucky. I like to test them before I shape them or sell them to someone, you know. But, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's not like your normal surfboard, for sure. You're putting your life, their life, under your board. Yeah.
Do you what about your daughter? Is she how's she in the whole big wave thing? Obviously, she's around you and the jet skis and stuff like that. You take her out. Is it something that she you see that she's got that twinkle in the eye, or is she looking to try and make it on tour? Like, where's your daughter at these days?
Yeah, well, she always as young, you know. You do all the they got all the little Grom comps here in Australia, and you know,
yeah.
Of course, I'd love to make the world tour. But you know, just naturally being around me and where I surf, she, you know, she was surfing, you know, yeah. She was at the, at Chopu with us when we filmed Point Break when she was 11, you know, so she got to surf Chopu at 11 and then all the years she was, you know, paddling out outside corner when she was like 12 and I told her not to come out and she paddled out and she's like, damn, yeah. I made it out. It's like 10 foot or low. I told you to stay in the rooms with your friends. and then I go shaping in Portugal and then the boys are like, hey, let's take her out, you know, let's take her on a small day, 10 feet. So she's like, yeah. So she's definitely got that twinkle in her eye and she loves it, you know. And then started taking to G-Land and now being back here, like I was started surfing the Cape Solander, which they call ours. So I started surfing that again. I was like, oh, do you want to come out? So she's like, I'll come out and have a look and I'll see if I get a wave. But then she was watching all of us get a wave and then she was like, yeah, Dad, give me one, you know. And I was just like, on your back end, just all right, this is what you got to do. And so yeah, she naturally got it and got that twinkle in her eye and just that no fear, you know. Just that same again, that natural progression of surfing the surfing Chopu Young to G-Land to all these waves around the world that help her to have that natural progression and then hanging around me.
Yeah, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, so they say. But one last question, but you know, you've been around a long time. You've obviously got a really good vision for just design, surfing. You've been around it a lot. You're working with one of the most progressive big wave surfers in the world with Lucas. But where do you see big wave surfing? Like, are you impressed with where it's at now? Obviously there's the we're paddling more, but, you know, toe surfing has its moments here and there. But, you know, are you impressed with it at the moment? I guess is the number one question. And then where do you see the next big, like, oh wow, what the hell was that moment? Like, where is that going to be? Like, from your perspective,
I'm being doing it so long and from the, you know, one of the first guys to do it, you know, and been watching the whole evolution. I'm so excited still to see what can happen. But I just think it's at a really good place right now. Especially with guys like Lucas Chumbo and Kai Lenny, what they're doing. I think it's going to more an extreme level and surfing big waves rather than just surviving and, you know, or just going straight. They're actually trying big turns and guys are trying to pull into like the biggest waves. Like tube riding, I think there's always going to be a place for that. I think the paddle surfing is amazing. The limits and the size and that's what it's exciting for me and trying to work out the boards, what the guys need. I just think there's so many facets of where it's at and where it's going. And there's still some of the biggest waves in the world that we can ride. And you see it like Nazare, what Lucas and Kai are doing, they're actually combination of turns and pulling in. And I just think it's just at a really good place. And I just think for competition, there's even more to come. with some more toe surfing as well. You know, imagine a giant swell at Chopu, or, you know, we're on call for Red Bull Cape Fear, what my daughter Summer's in, you know. I think some events like that where some maybe paddle and toe, I think, you know, I've been talking to, you know, with Kai and Lucas. They were supposed to come here just when COVID hit, and I was going to take them all around Australia. And the things they wanted to do at Shipsterns, they're like, man, I want to get that step. I want to be inside the barrel and do a 360 and land inside the barrel. Like, that's what these guys are thinking. And I think that's awesome. You know, that's where it's going. Like what happened with snowboarding and skateboarding and with the big mountain stuff. And yeah, I'm so excited to see what these guys are doing. And I'm so, it's so cool to be able to kind of talk to them and understand and surf them waves and understand what they need to be actually do that.
Yeah. And then equipment wise, I mean, it's so forever evolving so fast. The, you know, the materials that you can use, you think, you know, that's going to be a huge advantage, you know, and like, you know, step in the right direction with like all the different materials and all that sort of stuff as well, leading down the future.
Yeah, for sure. We're always trying to find something new, you know, performance wise is trying to keep them light enough and not be too heavy for paddle surfing. That's really important, you know, like again, like what Lucas and that want to do. But you know, when you're dealing with the wind coming up the face and stuff, you got to be careful of. So it's always, you know, having where you're going to have some stringers and flex and all. We're always working on something, but there's going to, you know, we're always looking for something new and something to improve in our boards and the technology we're using, whether it's small wave or big wave, again, in the tow boards. And we've just progressed so far with the tow boards I'm making for the guys at Nazare. And yeah, but there's always room for improvement and never say this is it. Always trying to make them better, and yeah, for sure.
That's awesome, mate. Well, give a shout out if someone wants to order a Dylan board. Where can they go, and how do they get into contact with you?
Yeah, just go to dylansurfboards.com or at Dylan Shapes through my Instagram. I'm easy contactable. Yeah, and drop me a line.
Awesome, Dylan. Well, appreciate your time, and it's what a career, man. Not many people can say that they've been sponsored by a major company for 29 or 30 years. So, congratulations on that, and it's great seeing you and surf with your daughter. I hope that I can do the same with my daughters when they get to that age. It's a real inspiration. So, thanks so much for being on the Late Drop.
Cheers for having me, mate. Good to have a chat.